Welcome, everyone, to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Black Jim Geary.
Well, we have a little change of pace this week. Usually we talk to game developers, people who are making a game or selling a game or something. We're changing tack a little bit this week, if I can use a naval term. We're talking to author John Hemry. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. Who goes by the pen name Jack Campbell, author of the Lost Fleet series. And if you guys have run the Lost Fleet series, this is the series I like to kind of liken it and think of it as kind of like futuristic Horatio Hornblower a little bit. I hope you take that as a compliment because I love Horatio Hornblower.
Yes.
So it's kind of like that. Basically, it revolves around this character named Jack Geary, who's known as Black Jack Geary, who was in hibernetic sleep for 100 years while this horrible war between these two human factions went on around him, basically. And he was thawed out just when what's the name of the faction he's in?
The Alliance.
The Alliance. I thought it was the Alliance. I read all six books. I'm fuzzy right now. They find his escape pod 100 years later, but because of attrition, the skill set and the education of the naval officers has gone basically in the toilet, and he kind of has to retrain his fleet because he ends up being the commander through this long slog back to safe space. And Jim was the one. I mean, I actually read the first book several years ago and then got distracted. I think I read the first book and then lost my job and then I couldn't buy any more books for a while. And so they kind of got pushed aside. You know, that happens. And then Jim, you were talking about your wife started reading them.
Yeah, we were on a road trip to Ohio, and I got the audiobook of the first one, and we listened to that on the trip up and back, and then as soon as we got home, she was like, "I must have the other. How many are there?" And you know, so she pretty much like chain read the entire series end to end, and since she was doing it on audiobook, you know, if she was in the room with me, I picked that up. I got through the first two and a half actually. You know, like in my commute and listening to that, and then I've picked up the rest of the story through talking to her, you know. But it's she and I actually we've had some kind of long conversations about that, and she really liked. I asked her to come on the show, but she's a little bit microphone shy. But she really liked the physics of the space combat because it was not a Star Trek / Star Wars. It's a little bit closer to hard sci-fi, although it makes some concessions to good storytelling. But also another thing that she pointed out was that John, for being a man, does not write women in a condescending way or in a ditzy way or whatever. So she was like, well, the women in the book are perhaps not wise because nobody's really wise anymore because of the attrition rate of the war. But as far as people, they're intelligent people. They've gotten into places of power. They haven't slept their way into those positions. They actually, you know, earned it. They're competent leaders and that. So, you know, because I asked her, I was like, well, you know, did you find anything off-putting at all in the portrayal of women? And she's completely satisfied with that. So I just thought I'd put that out there.
That's good to hear.
Now, you actually do have a military background, if I read correctly.
Yes, I do. I'm a retired Navy officer.
How did that translate? Like, how did you go from in the Navy and then retired to writing a sci-fi book series? Like, what was the chain of events or chain of thought that made that happen?
Well, I guess like most people who write, I'd always wanted to write. Kind of put that on hold during the years I was in the Navy, but I was picking up all kinds of experiences that would contribute to it. I mean, I was a ship driver, did amphibious stuff, lots of different things. You know, went lots of places, learned about engineering and how systems work in the real world, and met lots of different on lots of places, different specialists, you know, learned how Marines think and talk as opposed to the way engineers think and talk as opposed to the way pilots think and talk. They're all very distinct communities. And so when the time came to retire, the Cold War was winding down. They didn't need us anymore. So a lot of us were asked to depart as soon as possible. I decided to give it a shot, and my wife strongly encouraged me to give it a shot. She said, if you don't try it, you'll always wonder if you could. And so that's how I wandered into it. Started out doing both fantasy and science fiction, but most of what I've ended up writing was some form of science fiction or another.
Right. So why the choice to publish under a pen name?
Well, that was actually not entirely a choice. My first two series that came out, there was the Starks War series and then the Sinclair Jag in Space series. Starks War sold moderately well. The Jag in Space series was not too well marketed. As a matter of fact, the publisher sent it out initially with the first book in the series with a advertising line of a book about universal law. And not surprisingly, not too many people bought it. And as a result, the series, because of the way the software in the major book chains back then, still Borders and Barnes & Noble, ordered books, they got me into a death spiral where they would order fewer copies of each subsequent one, which meant less chance it would be noticed and picked up. So by the time the last book in the Jag in Space series came out, I was at the point where the major book chains wouldn't order my books.
Oh, no.
So my agent and my editor at the publisher both said, you need a new name. Because if you come in with a new name, the software says, hey, it's a new person. And then it orders more books. So I picked the Jack Campbell name to do a reset. And, you know, a lot of people have done that. You know, Megan Lindholm, Robin Hobb, she's done it. It's been required because of the nature of the marketplace these days. And now Jack Campbell has sold lots more books than John Henry did. So writing wise, I'm Jack Campbell for the foreseeable future.
That's crazy.
So whenever you want to launch into being a writer, do you just sit down and start writing something and then worry about trying to find an agent and a publisher later? Or do you seek out an agent and say, hey, I'm starting to write something, but, you know, let's say, you know, how much of a book do you need done before you say, okay, now I've written a bunch of this, but I need money to live on, you know, is anybody willing to bite on this? Maybe give me an advance or anything, or do you have to be established before you can have that conversation?
Yeah. Before you can sell something you haven't written, you definitely have to be established. Advice that just about every writer I know gives is that don't quit your day job if you want to write. You wait until maybe you get lucky enough to earn enough as a writer to do that. Until then, you keep your day job because, you know, if you're mid-list or even a little below that, the vast majority of writers, you know, you're not making a lot of money. You're doing it more for the love of the thing than otherwise. If you want to get in, you definitely have to have a product to show, a story that shows you know how to write, you know how to make good characters, and you have interesting ideas. All those things are important. If you do that, then it's hard to get agents these days. It's actually much easier to try to make some sales, and that's, if you're writing short fiction, that's easier now than it ever was when I came in, because now you've got all the online markets.
Because growing up, I read a lot of like Asimov magazine, a lot of the compilations of short science fiction. You know, where you get somebody's ideas and get an idea where they're going, but you know, but you don't have to bite off like, you know, a 2,000-page tome of a thing. You know,
I started out writing mostly short fiction, and I think that's a good thing to do if you're starting out as a writer, because it gets you room to play around. You can start something. If it doesn't work, you can abandon it, which you wouldn't if you'd already spent, you know, 500 pages working on a novel. But doing the short fiction, it teaches you how to do things economically, how to write well. It gives you experience with a lot of different ideas and different concepts. You can play around a lot more. So I do recommend that people start out by writing short fiction, if that's something they can do.
Has the internet greatly changed the environment for that? Because it's much easier to get an audience and to get out, you know, because it's not like we have to get published in Asimov or something, or Omni, or whatever existed back then. However, there is such a wide playing field, I would think that it's tough to get eyes on your product.
Yeah, that's the contradiction. On the one hand, it is much easier to get yourself out there. When I started it, there was no market to speak of. You had Asimov's, Analog, Fantasy and Science Fiction, and a couple of minor print magazines. Now, odds are you can get yourself out there some way, even if all you do is post a story online yourself. But as you say, the problem is getting noticed when there's so much else out there these days. And that is difficult, getting that word of mouth, getting people to notice. Luck plays a big part of it. I mean, luck plays a big part in success in writing, no matter how you're doing it. Having just the right concept at the right time, having people notice it. But it's important today. And some people are really good at the online promotion, better at it than others, and that doesn't hurt at all. But at the end of the day, you've got to have a good product to sell. You know, you've got to have a good story. You've got to have something different and something about your writing that makes people want to read it.
So when did the Lost Fleet series take form? When did you begin writing on that? What year?
Well, I actually started writing it in, would have been about 2005, 2006. 2004, excuse me. But the ideas behind it I had been playing with for, several years before then.
Mm.
I'd actually come up with the half of it when a writer who works in the Star Trek universe asked a bunch of other writers. She said, can you do a long retreat in space in Star Trek?
Mm.
And we all said, no, it wouldn't work because of the way Star Trek handles faster-than-light travel. You'd either get away or you'd be caught.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't do that. But it got me to thinking, could you do a long retreat in space in a way that made sense, that worked? And that was just stayed in the back of my head for a long time. And then there was another concept I'd been thinking about for a long time, this idea of the sleeping hero, which is a common thing in human cultures. It's all over the place. The ones we're most familiar with, you know, somebody like King Arthur, who's supposedly not dead, just sleeping, and when needed, will wake up and save his people.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, they say that this sleeping hero people, that they're originally somebody real was behind all that. And I just thought, what if that real person actually did wake up and discover, hey, we think you're the greatest hero ever, and you got to save us.
Right. But he was just an average Joe that was
right
in a lucky situation, right? Where the parallel that I saw in that whenever I heard it the first time was actually in the 2009 Star Trek movie, right? Where Kirk's dad stays the lone guy on the bridge and basically does the last stand against the enemy to allow all the civilians to escape, right? So it'd be instead of him dying, you know, gloriously in that, but he was just thought dead and great legends sprang up about him, right? But then they find him as a popsicle many years later and thaw him out, and then he has to have the crisis of trying to live up to the legend that was built about him. So I find that's kind of interesting though, about the whole that last stand against the enemy, just, you know, trying to go out saving as many people as you can and self-sacrifice. And then just through pure dumb luck, he actually gets discovered, you know, what was it, like 100 years later?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes. Yeah, it's, the last stand, that's one of the toughest things that can happen in the military. And it happens. And so it's a situation that naturally makes you think, what would someone do in a case like that? Would you live up to the requirements? Would you be able to hold your ground? There's even a phrase for it, you know, the forlorn hope, which tells you what, you know, is expected in the last stand. You're not expected to make it out. And it takes a special kind of person to stick through that. And so it's an interesting, very interesting topic to try to write about.
Yeah. When you were in the Navy, did you get any submarine time, or was it all surface ships?
I spent some time on submarines. You know, it's only a few days at a time, not extensively.
Okay, because it's a thing that I have always been interested in, and I don't know what your computer gaming experience is, but some of the submarine simulations that had been made that were that were super deep, and submarine stuff is always a game of detection. Of course, surface ships are too. You know, who sees the enemy first generally wins. But with submarines, it's a cat and mouse game, and it's about detection and that. And I have always thought, well, nobody's really done a space game where they look at the actual physics of just interstellar flight or in-system flight. And one of the things that struck home with me in your books immediately was that, well, the best detection is with light because that's the fastest wave. And if you're detecting with anything else, it's too slow. You know, you can't use like radio emissions or whatever. It takes way too long. And then if you use active sensors, it takes twice as long because the ping has to go out and then come back. So it's basically passive sensors keyed off a light seems to be what everybody does. So is that on these ships, are the sensors actually just arrays of telescopes that are scanning at all times looking for any kind of photon emissions or?
Well, not just telescopes. I mean, they're sensors that are looking across the entire spectrum, the full spectrum from, you know, the deep infrared up to the highest ultraviolet, looking for any emissions anywhere along that.
Okay.
Because, you know, objects are going to give off heat, which you're going to see as you know, light radiation. Or radio waves can come off them, you know, any number of things. So you're going to be looking through the entire spectrum.
Okay.
And I mean, we do that now to some extent. We try to look at a full spectrum analysis to try to spot things that would not be visible if you were just looking in one part of the visual spectrum, for example.
Okay. But is it pretty much it's a detection game? Because they see when somebody jumps into a system, I would assume that there's a flare of energy, and it's very obvious that somebody just entered the system. But that light got to you, you know, 4 hours after the event, 20 hours after the event. It just depends on how far you are. And this is actually the first series that I'd read that takes into account that light and communications take time between ships. And when you're commanding a formation of ships, then when you issue orders, you know there's a 5 to 10 minute delay before that guy's even going to hear you and then begin to act. And then as far as like the red shift of as you begin to approach, you know, a fraction of light speed, you know, say around 10% or whatever, that your perception of space around you begins to distort. So you can't really pick targets. And if it takes a laser, we always think of that as an instantaneous thing because light's so fast. But if it actually takes a couple minutes or, you know, just even seconds for a shot to get to a target and you can't clearly see where that target is and they're maneuvering, so your computers would have pretty much a cone of prediction to shoot in. But when you're shooting with a beam of light, you have to be pretty precise. So I would think that, you know, the space combat would be pretty tough. So that's going to dictate slower speeds and closer range, or you're not going to have a hope of hitting anything.
Yeah, closer range. I mean, I approach the whole thing from an attitude of not how it's been done in the past, but and I guess this was my Navy training. I was looking at like, okay, if this is a real situation, if this is your real battlefield, and it's literally infinite in dimensions, and there's very little in the way of obstacles, and you can see for tremendous distances, you know, what are your ships going to have to be like? What are they going to have to be capable of, and how are they going to fight? And I decided to try, you know, taking into account the real light speed stuff instead of the instantaneous communications and sensor stuff, because I wanted to see if I could make it work. Oh, and inadvertly, one of the thank you,
so fantastic.
One of the side effects of that was that I finally managed to get across how big space is, because you know when you're talking about thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kilometers, any person's eyes are going to glaze over. We can't get numbers like that. But if you say it's going to take an hour for light to go from this point to where the other ship is, then people can say, wow, that's big. It presents the vastness of space in a way that, that we can grasp.
It's instantly understandable, which I thought was great. Now, I wanted to say there's a few things I loved about your space combat besides the time dilation and everything. One, that you still – that the futuristic Navy still relies on physical munitions, which just makes sense.
You know? Yeah, some of them. Yeah, like the grape shot. You know, it's just – I mean, it's a kinetic projectile. It's moving at high speed. It's going to do a lot of damage if it hits something.
Exactly. I also loved how rocks were used for orbital bombardment. That was a favorite of mine.
Yeah. Well, again, if you don't need a warhead if you're dropping something from that high up, it's going to do a tremendous amount of damage. And of course, it's much easier to manufacture a solid chunk of metal than it is to build something with a warhead in it.
Exactly, or something that shoots a laser beam or something like that.
Yeah, it's like putting a nuclear bomb in. You know, when you drop a shell that's multi-ton from orbit, then putting a nuke on it is just sort of an afterthought because it's already going to do
the
damage.
What's the point, really?
Yeah, what's the point?
Exactly. I also loved how, because of the time needed to make combat happen, it kind of shows the hurry up and wait facet of combat really well. There's a lot of just time waiting, and there's seconds of pure terror as the ships fly by each other, shooting all kinds of things, and then you got to figure out what to do next. I really love that aspect of the combat.
Yeah, that was, and again, I thought that was something about space combat that you'd have, because the ships have to be able to move very fast, and it doesn't make sense that they would move very, very fast and then slow down to a dead stop next to each other when they actually fought. They'd tear past each other like SR-71's dogfighting, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's been games in the long history. Oh God, Brian, how long have we been playing these games? Since the 80s? But
at least
in the history,
how long I've been playing them.
Yeah.
Oh, you do play them.
Oh yeah, I've definitely played some. Yeah, Commander on. You know,
We will have to talk about your bona fides in that area a little bit later.
Yeah. Did you when you were in the Navy? Did you guys break out Harpoon a lot? And
Harpoon was just coming online. There wasn't very much of it, actually.
Well, I mean, I, as far as the board game, was there much?
Yeah, I bought a copy of the board game. Not too much, mainly because when you're a member of ship's company, spare time is something you spend sleeping if you can.
Yeah.
Basically, you don't have much of a life. So I didn't do much wargaming when I was on ship's company. We were too busy doing the real thing. So
okay.
It didn't leave room for that.
Well, I also wanted to say I love how your series mixes. I mean, there is faster than light travel, but that doesn't mean once you break out of your warp your jump tube or whatever, that things are instantaneous. There's no like magic sensor or magic engine that makes everything just happen. You know, it just felt much more grounded.
Yeah, and really that makes me, that kind of thing makes me write better, because I can't depend on a magic sensor or a magic weapon. I've got to figure out, how would you actually do this? How would my characters actually command in these situations? How could you actually do things? And it makes me write it as if it was real.
Mm-hmm. Have you actually plotted the combat out on like graph paper or anything? Have you done like that? Is it all in your head? Like, how do you plot out?
It's three dimensional. I do it in my head because, you know, I use my experience as a ship driver.
Mm.
I did, you know, I had to know relative motion and the relative motion of very large objects moving around each other, and then different rates of it with the aircraft above and the submarines below. So I work it out in my head.
Yeah, and there really aren't, if I recall, there really aren't like fighters in this universe, but it would kind of like not make sense to have them.
No, they don't really. I mean, Lucas started the whole space fighter thing because, he was doing a movie. And they made great visuals to have a space fighter thing. So he copied World War II Pacific battles.
Exactly.
You know, the reason you've got fighters and ships on Earth is because the fighters are operating in air, and the ships are operating in the water. In space, they're all operating in the exact same environment, which means a big ship with a big engine is just as maneuverable as a little ship with a little engine. It's thrust to mass. So the space fighter is basically doesn't have those maneuvering advantages that it would in a planetary environment. Instead, it's just got less of everything. So I think you could make a case for a PT boat like space fighter.
That makes sense.
Relatively short endurance and, you know, one punch situation. But if you're talking fighters, then you're talking something, you know, aerospace, something close to a planet that can pop in and out of that air and can do things close in.
Right. And the fleet doesn't really get too close to planets, usually.
Yeah, well, I mean, otherwise you'd need some sort of a barrier that they would have to slip past. Like, if it was a standoff, like in the recent reboot of Battlestar Galactica, the way that they kind of justified the fighters there is because, well, they have one military ship and it can't be everywhere. So that helps. But also the combat would be, you know, the Cylon base star jumps in. It's stationary. The Galactica is fairly stationary. And they have a missile duel. And it's basically, we're going to throw so many missiles at each other and just hope that some get in. But you have just an area of devastation in the middle. And in order to get shots in, you send your fighters and your bombers around the outside to kind of do flanking. And it worked for that. But that's because the two primary combatants are stationary as opposed
It's funny that a lot of those battles, I mean, you're basically talking a line of battle engagement. Like if they were on the surface of the ocean, you've got the big battleships slugging away at each other.
Yeah.
And you've got the smaller ships trying to swing in there and fire torpedoes and stuff, getting closer. And the other side's small escorts are trying to stop them and everything. It's funny how often that scenario shows up in space. And you can make the technology justify it. You know, if you put your technology in a certain way, you can justify it. But to me, I always see the battleship slamming away at each other when something like that happens. Which is good.
It's much more naval. I mean, we identify with the Star Wars and the Battlestar because it's a little more. It's kind of approachable. It's like all fast paced and visual. And I think it'd be. Like, have you ever considered making these books into, like, a visual medium, like a TV show or a movie? I can't imagine that would be easy.
No. It'd be interesting. There's somebody trying to market them right now.
Oh,
and,
wow.
The books are big in Japan. They sell well in Japan. So, I have a hope that, you know, some anime studio will give it a shot.
That's exactly where I was going. I was going to say you need to talk to some anime people because they can make anything on the cheap because, you know, environment doesn't matter and special effects, they can do whatever, right? You know, we got giant robots.
Oh, yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah.
They're amazing. I was just watching Girls und Panzer, which is just outstanding recreations of World War II era tanks. It's amazing what they did with them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, you would not even think of Western animators wouldn't even think of recreating the specific views through the range finders of the different tanks, model tanks. But they've got that in there. You look through the range finder of a Firefly, and it's the range finder of a Firefly. You look through of a Mark IV Panzer, and it's the viewfinder of a German tank. Amazing.
So in your ships, because we were talking about the battle tactics a bit there, and where Jack Geary, because he was from the old school and he was trained whenever he was before the attrition basically sucked all the wisdom out of the military. So he remembered how to fight in formations and use more advanced tactics and that had just evaporated from the scene by the time he came back, which made him sort of a super commander because he knew how to use, you know, common sense and maneuvers. So those things, as far as the maneuvers and that he did, like I said, I've gotten a lot less through the books than Brian and my wife did. So maybe this came up, but is there a valid tactic in there for just running silent, like just shut all your emissions off once you're headed toward the enemy and cruise in and then you get a first strike before they detect you, you know, it, because that would make it more like submarine combat, right? You get going the right way, you shut everything down, and then you get a sneak attack kind of thing.
Well,
but this, they always seem to stay together in groups, almost like a bomber.
Yeah, the state of human sensors in the Lost Fleet universe is such that it's very hard for a large object to be stealthy. You can do it with smaller ones like mines or something, but if you've got something big and it's moving fast, at this point they can't hide it. There are ways to hide things. Don't want to spoil things for you, but like the alien Enigmas figure out a way to hide from human ships. Basically, they're hacking them. Because, you know, once, if you're only looking at the universe through your systems, then, you know, there's your Achilles heel as far as stealth.
So how much automation is involved in these ships? Because you have, it's fully crewed by humans, and like even the gun turrets require like, what is it, 3 or 4 crew to man one of the, you know, one of the, they weren't called laser turrets, hell lances. So to do that, so you made it so that it's not like, you know, the Syndicate could just send robot ships out or whatever and not have a human element.
Yeah, obviously you need a human element. But also, and again, this is Navy experience and what's going on right now. The robotic systems, they have a tendency to have glitches. If you don't have a human in the loop who's there to override the glitch and reset things, well, you're stuck.
Right,
it's like, but, you know, you send something to Mars and it gets a glitch and oops.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I guess where I'm looking at is like you're targeting computers and things like that, because you have such a delay between when you see an enemy and when you decide to pull the trigger on them, and then you have flight time of your ordnance to get there. So the enemy, of course, well, if the shot is coming in at light speed, the first warning that they're going to have is getting hit by it, because they're not going to see it coming because it comes at the speed of their perception. So it's a thing of like, once you know the enemy's there and they're approximately in range, then you, I would assume you flip the switch and start some random evasive maneuvers to try to not be as predictably in the place where their ordnance is going to be shot.
Yeah, you do try to wobble a bit, which is where something like Grapeshot comes in handy, because it's a little of an area weapon. But because the ships are moving so fast, your engagement window, where you're actually within range, is incredibly tiny in time terms.
Yeah.
And so the combat computers are pretty much, you say, okay, fire at this when we get in range, and they pull the trigger because it's happening too fast for human senses to react. And then you come back around and you do it again. But it's you're heavily dependent on automated systems for the fire control, because it's simply happening too fast for human senses to register, usually. Right.
So a lot of the games that we have played, of course, they bow to the George Lucas aesthetics, right? Wing Commander and that. Yeah, well, and it
yeah,
makes sense to people, right? So, but the other game, the one that stands out hugely is, what was it? It was Elite Frontier. Was that the one, Brian?
It was
a David Braben thing. It was Frontier 2, I think. It was the one that we talk about where it just descended into jousting combat every time.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, Elite 2 and 3 have the same problem.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's the thing, is you would detect an enemy and you head toward them and they're coming at you, and the closure rate is so fast that you get like 2 shots and zip past each other. And then you turn 180, and of course, you know, momentum, right? So you have to lose all that speed and then accelerate at each other again, and you take a couple of shots at the nose and repeat until somebody gets lucky. But the combat in Lost Fleet wasn't so much like that, because it was formations of ships. So you would get somebody every time, you know.
And I actually used the models for the formation that I thought of were – World War II bomber boxes, because, you know, it's the heavy bombers. It's a three-dimensional formation providing interlocking fire. And so that kind of thing, yeah, you could do that in space. It would make sense.
Well, and one ship's not going to be able to project enough grape shot on its own. to guarantee a hit. Exactly. But if you get 10 ships and they all throw a bunch of ball bearings out there,
right,
you get a cloud. So,
and the ships have shields, so you have to, you know, first knock down the shield, and then you have to get through any armor on the hull, and then hope you hit something vital.
Yeah. So when you were designing the technology of this, did you start writing, you know, these are the situations and the things that I want, or did you kind of sweat out the details of, okay, this is the kind of technology level that I'm going to go for? You know, like, which came first, the technology or the situation that demanded it?
Well, I knew in general what I wanted to do, you know, like have battles in systems at sublight speeds. And then it was a matter of figuring out what technology would work with the way I'd set things up. Because I needed to have that in order to know how the story was going to go. The situations my characters would encounter and the things they could do and what they couldn't do. Because a lot of things that happen in a story, a lot of things that drive a story, just like in real life, is what you can't do. It's nice to be able to do something, but more often than not, the decisive factor is, well, I can't do this. I'd love to be able to do it, but I can't. So here's my available options. So I need to know what they could do and what they couldn't do.
Right.
In order to figure out how the story would go.
Because whenever we have discussions, like in our IRC channel, there's a couple of people that I talked to in there. And there was a board game that's Attack Vector Tactical. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Ad Astra made it. And then they also got the license for the Honor Harrington universe. So he produced some games in that. And that's it's an interesting game. It's very difficult to make the mental hurdle of the cliff of learning that thing because you have to do vector calculations in your head, basically. And they give you a cheat sheet that kind of helps. But you are playing a hex-based vector movement game. And to try to conceptualize where you're going to end up at the end of, you know, two turns from now if you execute like a 90-degree turn and thrust, and it's kind of mind-bending. But in a game like that, one of the things – his ships have these giant radiators on the tail. And I talked to him. I can't remember his name right now, but it was some years ago, and we had a conversation. And – you know, I asked him, well, with the radiators on there, and he said, well, he had talked to some NASA guys and said, you know, had some discussions about, well, if we had these ships for real and if they were going to be in any way plausible. And they said, well, the problem is if in order to have enough thrust from the ship to be able to accelerate to like a tenth of light speed in anything under a matter of months, then you're going to have to put out so much energy that any kind of conduction of that energy back through the hull of the ship is just going to cook the crew. So you have to have a way to radiate that, and it's a problem, right? And then as far as actually being able to accelerate a ship that quickly and then change its direction and do things so that you can have a cinematic engagement rather than be, you know, well, we flew past each other and took a shot, and it'll be about 5 days before we can get turned around. and go back there. So you have to make some concessions to story, right?
Yes.
But but do you sweat the stuff about, well, I'm going to say these ships have shields, but do I have to think about, you know, how do shields actually work? And
well,
or do you just say, well, you know, Star Wars, Star Trek, it's an accepted thing, and we'll just say shields and everybody will accept that?
I guess sort of half and half. I mean, again, you have to have a set a limitation on what this thing can do to prevent it from becoming the magic get out of jail free card system that's going to solve your problem. So kind of a combination of both. I want to have a system that's clearly enough defined to have clear things it can do and can't do. But at the same time, I don't want to get into nuts and bolts details because, you know, we don't know how this stuff's going to work. I've had people ask me, how does the artificial gravity work? And I don't know.
Yeah.
If I knew that, that would be a good thing.
Well, it's a thing I think that's good enough. You know, when it colors the story and it feels like, okay, some concessions are made to reality, but, you know, there's enough reality to ground it in that, where it's not pure space fantasy, you know, space opera thing.
Yes, but absolutely.
Then again, you have to throw some assumptions in to say, well, this is fun and it drives the story, so we'll allow it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like you were talking about the vector stuff. When I think about space combat with basically limited thrust, limited power capability, and lots and lots of momentum, I think of things like galley warfare, you know, back in the old days where they really had to pre-plan everything they did because they only had so much propulsion power. And once they committed to something, they were on that, and changing it was hard. And I think space combat will have a lot of similarities to that, at least at first, where you really have to pre-plan your moves and figure out where you're going to be three moves down the line, how your vectors are going to work out. Because you can't just spin on a dime and stop on a dime. It's going to be a big part of it.
Yeah. Has anybody talked to you about maybe a board game adaptation?
Not seriously at this point, no. It's it would be interesting to try to do that, but there have been no serious talks as of yet.
Okay, I think it would be an interesting, like, Harpoon in Space kind of thing. You know, if it had its own consistency that obeyed the laws of its universe, which seems to be, you know, the goal you set for yourself and lived up to, is you establish these are the laws of my universe and then you obey them throughout. Because that was the thing that my wife had said was, well, there was no Wesley Crusher character. Nobody invented magic and changed stuff. And I was like, well, did the weapons change at all? And she's like, no, they just figured out how to use what they had better. But it was a thing of attrition. Like, you're always working with less. So
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, as I said before, it makes me write better because I can't just, oh, we'll invent this and it'll get us out of this. When I was doing the sixth book, and I was coming into the climactic battle in the Syndicate's home star system, it was too easy. It was just going to be too easy for the Alliance to win. So I thought, I've got to come up with something that the bad guys can do to make this hard. And I did. I came up with a trap. It was a beautiful trap. It was such a beautiful trap that I had no idea how the good guys were going to get out of it using the technology they had. And it literally took me a couple of months to figure out how they could do it. But I wasn't going to take a shortcut. I was, you know, okay, they're stuck. This is the situation. What are they going to do? And eventually I figured out what they could do.
So when you write, I think, do you start with the end situation and then backfill to figure out how they got there? Or do you start out as these are some key points that I want to hit? Or do you start at the beginning and you're just as surprised as the rest of us where it ends up?
Yes. it does tend to be a combination of things. I usually have at least a general idea of the ending, sometimes a very specific one. I know where we're starting. And then I will have a general idea of where I'm going in between there. But as I'm writing, I'm going to let the characters make decisions as they're presented with situations. And they may make decisions that are not what I was originally thinking. And then I try to accommodate those. Because as the characters go on, they develop their own – I mean, they've got real personalities. And I don't want them – you know how this kind of story where the characters are just doing things because they've got to do that for the plot?
Right.
You know, like the typical horror movie thing where, oh, let's all separate now. Let's go off by ourselves so the monster can get us all one by one. I wanted to avoid that. So I always let my characters have a say in how the story goes. And sometimes that produces some significant changes in the story.
It sounds like the writing technique of playing chess against yourself where, you know, you sit down, make your move, and then spin the board around and let the other guy, you know.
Yeah, I was
going to say it sounds more like a pen and paper role playing game in your head where you're not only the GM, but every member of your party making decisions as you go.
Well, yeah, I suppose there's a lot to that. You know, I was one of the first people to buy a Dungeons and Dragons game and draw out the dungeons on the graph paper and everything. And,
see, that's another market for this. You've got a source book, or, you know, you could make like the Lost Fleet Bible, right? Of like the locations and the whatever. Like, and just have a compendium and say, oh yeah, this is adaptable to Star Frontiers and GURPS and, you know, whatever people play these days. But yeah, I think a compendium of that for the fans would be something that people would eat up, you know, especially dive into the technologies. And
yeah, I was going to ask if you have like stats for all the ships. Do you have like, you know, the complement and the tonnage and the speed and all that fun and the armament? Do you have all that mapped out?
Well, yeah, but not well organized. We've had some preliminary talks with some people about doing a tech manual type thing for the Lost
Legacy. I would buy that day one. Day freaking one. Especially if it came in hardcover. You would have a sale, sir. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I love science fiction technical manuals.
We were actually talking about maybe doing it in the form of an Alliance intelligence document. You know, it's laying out, you know, here's our assessment of the situation and here's the enemy ships and here's our ships. And so it would be positioned within the universe itself rather than something external to it.
Right. Now, one thing I wanted to say I love about the space combat is that not every ship in the fleet is a combatant. You have these auxiliary ships, which are amazingly important. But in a lot of other sci-fi series, you usually don't. They barely touch on that sort of thing. Like, I think BSG had that one episode with the mining ship that made jump fuel or something, but that was like it, and it wasn't very good. But you properly make the auxiliaries very, very important.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize the importance of logistics in the situation. I mean, the auxiliaries make their fuel cells, they right. make their expendable weaponry, you know, food's an issue. A lot of science fiction stories do avoid that. They have the miracle power source that lasts for 5 years.
The replicators.
That kind of stuff. But, you know, in the real world, you look at the historical situation, stuff that's going on now, logistics drives an awful lot of the decisions people make.
Well, especially when you're in a long retreat scenario, because that's your most important thing is to keep in supply.
Exactly, and that because that does drive real world decisions. By putting that in there, it makes it feel real to people because they say, even if they don't recognize it necessarily, consciously, subconsciously, they know, yeah, this is like in the real world, and I think that pays off.
Yeah, because that's a massive factor in the decisions Gary makes throughout the entire base series, which is great. You know, because a lot of science fiction skips that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're running out of fuel and you're like, man, is this going to last long enough for me to get home? Is it going to last long enough for me to win this battle? That's real world.
Yeah, and it's like, what do you do? Yeah. What do you do with your auxiliaries? We're about to engage in combat. Where can I put them that they're safe?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and also I could sacrifice gunships in order to keep the auxiliaries safe. You know, it's like I might lose people, but if I leave them open, then, you know, and not make that sacrifice, you know, it's like I have to lose some swords to keep the butter.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask, especially when it comes to protecting auxiliaries and stuff, there was, in the early part of the books at least, a lot of resistance to how Gary tried to run the fleet. They just wanted to go gung-ho and didn't want to listen and didn't want to coordinate. Did you kind of run into people that were that stubborn in the actual military?
Well, you do. You always run into them, yeah. But in this particular case, I was using the examples, which are unfortunately very prevalent in history, of cases where nothing's working. And so people just fall back on pride and beating their heads against the wall. You know, the World War One type scenario where, okay, it didn't work. Let's do it again. It didn't work. Let's do it again. And people actually do that simply out of frustration, simply because it's something they can do. That sort of simplistic belief that honor and courage will carry the day against firepower, and it doesn't.
Hmm. Oh, you guys were bringing up anime earlier. Knack in the chat says anime does a better job of dealing with support ships and auxiliaries than a lot of Western sci-fi. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And that's probably because Japan, you know, they're in the Pacific. To them, it was always long distance, long missions type situations. I think they're better suited for it. Americans tend to think in terms of continental stuff. We got a big country. And it's hard to get too far away from your base. But I think the Japanese do pay more attention to that kind of thing.
Well, it makes sense. Because I want a game, man. I want a game of your books. Seriously. I know there'd be a lot of time compression involved between engagements. But I still want that. I still want – because did you ever play the Rules of Engagement series back in the day?
Oh, gosh, I don't think so. I mean, the name is familiar to me, but I can't remember ever playing it.
They didn't deal with the dilation of light and everything the way that your books do, but they came the closest to having to deal with they kind of did, because messages – if ships were farther away, messages would take longer to get to members of your fleet. So they kind of dealt with it a little bit, but that was, I'm thinking, the closest we've come – to what your books tackle. And those are great games. Those are phenomenal games. Kind of hard to play now because the interface is crazy. But
but nothing can be as bad as that, what was it, like 1973 Star Trek that you were playing?
Trek 73. That's what it was actually called. And I got called to task for that. I don't know. Did you ever play that game, John? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Was that the one that worked on a mainframe and you just typed in the commands?
It was one of the many that were between the 60s and like early to mid 70s. There were a bunch of Star Trek games that came out. And the most popular and most well-known of those is one where like you had a 9-point grid, kind of like a numeric keypad, and you would use the numeric keypad to kind of point, like go down like 90 degrees, or, you know, and you would use the keypad to tell, you know, which direction to shoot, which direction to move. With this one, you actually had to type it all out, and it was crazy difficult.
Yeah, it wasn't the one I remember then. The one I remember, we quickly figured out that there was one maneuver you could do as soon as a Klingon showed up. You do this one maneuver, and you fire at this one angle, and you'd always nail him. Bam, bam, bam.
Henceforth known as the hammering maneuver.
After you figure out the trick, yeah.
The hammering.
You know, you figure out the trick, and then, okay, no challenge here, because it was a pretty one-dimensional game.
Well, they all kind of were back in the day. I mean, some of them still hold up, though. The Super Star Trek I was just talking about from, 1978, that's still fun. And Starfleet, remember Starfleet from still? Yeah, that's kind of an EGA Trek and Net Trek. Those are kind of the same kind of formula but built upon that base of the numeric keypad to do everything. And those are still fun games. I still play them every once and again.
You know, when you couldn't depend on the graphics to try to carry the game, the flash, then you had to have a better game. You
know, I agree.
You try to build a good game out of it.
Well, and that, you said you, there sorry. Wasn't so much effort that could go into the graphics, right? So if you have X amount of development time, the bulk of it is going to go into the AI and this, you know, the user interface and such. I think that current developers are kind of in a hard place, because you can make the coolest game ever. But if it doesn't stand up visually, like somebody will look at a screenshot and be like, oh, you know, and then you just don't get it.
Yeah. Like some games still are into that. Like we just had a couple weeks ago, it was a Tactical Space Command.
Yeah, which is a phenomenal game that looks like a radar.
Harpoon.
Screen.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Harpoon. It's basically there's planets and there's rings around them. And then you have your ships that are symbols on the map. And, you know, my diamond has a circle around it, and that's my detection radius, and I can organize them into a fleet. And it's a pretty cool game. I actually sat and played it the whole time we were doing the podcast. I had a stream going of me being terrible at this game.
yeah.
But losing horribly. But yeah, fun game. But there, visually, there's not much there. But it doesn't need to be, because it actually has an authenticity in that you're kind of looking at a radar scope and pushing your guys around a map. So
there's definitely still a market for that sort of thing. It's just not as big as the whiz-bang, flash-bang, Star Citizen-y, Elite Dangerous-y.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting, though, in that game. And I think we actually brought that up on that show, you know, thinking about John's books. Because when you give orders to a ship and then it engages in combat in that, what would happen if there was a delay? You know, like, I might not find out for a couple minutes what actually transpired, because it takes that long for the signals to come back to home base. So
right. So now, John, you mentioned Wing Commander earlier. What would you say some of the other big space games you've really loved? What would some of those be?
Oh God, I'm trying to remember. It's been I've had this subsequent life with the kids and everything, where I haven't been able to do as nearly as much.
How old are your kids now? Wing Commander stands out.
Well, the oldest two are 20 and 19. They're both autistic, so they're still with us. And then the youngest one is 16.
And so, he's not autistic.
Well, he's on the spectrum. We got a triple play, but we've got him just about recovered. So he's doing okay.
What does that mean? Just about recovered.
Well, but by a combination of medications and diet, we were able to get him. So he's pretty much typical in terms of social interaction and everything else. He was always smart, but at one point he was withdrawing and losing language and stuff. But we compensated for that and got him back.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating that recently they've made such strides in the treatment. Because they realize, you know, it's not just, oh, that's what you got and, you know, deal with it. It's more like, well, you actually can work with this and, you know. And,
yeah. Long ways to go, unfortunately. So it makes life interesting. Trying to remember the Moo, Master of Orion.
Ah, of course. Of course.
Didn't like Moo 2, though. It's just got too much into detail.
Really?
You know. I just remember it being just, you know, you had to spend so much time doing bookkeeping stuff between your planets, you didn't have time to play the game.
We're going to get letters on this one.
Probably. That's just how I remember. I could be wrong. It's been a long time.
Now, no one's saying you're wrong. It's just most people I talk to about Moo there. It's like one of those things where, like, ooh, you know, Moo 2, ooh. Oh my God, it's the best thing. It's the best thing ever. Still.
Really?
How many years? It's like 18 fucking years. Oh my God. It came out in 1996.
They might have modified it a lot since the time when I remember it from. You know, they might have automated a lot of the things that were tedious.
You know, for the most part, I let all the automation happen in that game because I enjoyed designing the ships, but I did not like micromanaging combat. But I didn't trust the auto resolution. I wanted to see it. In case the AI was something ignorant. So I would build these ships, you know, and spend a lot of time designing them, but then I'd just go and be a spectator to the combat and kind of, you know, either experience joy or rage based on what the AI did.
That was a part of it, was building the ships. Yes, definitely.
Have you ever played Sword of the Stars? The first one, not the second one. The second one's bad.
I don't think so.
Oh, really good game. And cheap too. You can pick it up for like $10 on Steam. Mm-hmm. What was interesting in that is that each race came with a completely different propulsion technology and weapon technology that they, you know, so depending on who you were playing, you had a completely different play style. Like there was an insectoid race that could reproduce very quickly, but they couldn't travel very fast at all. So they would travel at sublight speed, and it would take them multiple years to get to another system. So they would be very late to the game in creating colonies. However, when they did start to make colonies, they would colonize everything in sight and then launch out again. You know, so every time they would land, they would reproduce in mass, launch a zillion ships, and you would have woe be on you if you were in a close planet and they showed up. And then once they established in a system, they could build a gate, and nobody else had gate technology. So they could – it took forever to get there, but once they built a Stargate, then their entire fleet could come in.
Yeah, I remember that game now. Yeah, it was neat because it had all those distinctive characteristics. You know, yeah. Everybody wasn't basically the same except they looked different.
Mm-hmm. So you have – in your books, you have one alien race, but there's not a whole lot that's really revealed about them, right? Like
actually, by now, there's three.
Oh, three different alien races?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because
you got to catch up, man.
Well, further.
Yeah. Well, so do I.
Well,
so do I.
Well, it's books beyond the Lost Fleet.
Right. Into the Beyond the Frontier. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the thing about the aliens, as far in, I didn't hear the sixth book, but she's told me about it, right? And but it's the thing of like there was never a meeting of. Oh, here's the aliens, and here's what they look like, and here's how they act, and that they were still a mystery,
but, right? The enigmas, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, do you ever actually spill the beans on all that stuff, or do you keep them an enigma?
More stuff gets learned about them, but they are, as it turns out, a by human standards, a very paranoid race, very secretive.
Right. Because it seemed like
do not want anybody else finding out anything about them.
And it seemed like the thing was they were manipulating the two human factions to fight each other, because as long as the humans are busy wiping each other out, then we don't have to worry about them encroaching.
Yes, this is a slight spoiler, but basically we figure out the Alliance fleet figures out at one point that the reasons the Enigmas are so scared of us, want to get rid of us, is because we are – you know, we're the monkey race. We are very curious. We always want to learn about things. And to them, that is the worst possible thing because they don't want anybody learning about them. So that's driving their motivations as far as we're concerned. They don't want anything to do with us. They don't want us anywhere near them because they don't want us learning about them.
Right, because absence of knowledge is pretty good security, right? If you don't know who we're here and you don't know what our capabilities are, then you're less prone to mess with us because you don't exactly know what our limits are.
Exactly. And then, in the Beyond the Frontier series, they encounter two other races, the Kicks and the Dancers.
Okay. So are the further books also like large fleet type of fiction, or do they get more into an individual character and his, like a ship?
It varies. Geary's fleet is actually shrinking some due to attrition. Mm-hmm. And I'm also scaling back. You know, one of the things you have to worry about in any series is kind of the Lensman effect, where things just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, before long, you're fighting galaxies are exploding and, you know, the fate of the universe is at hand. It's a trap you get caught in. Mm-hmm. And so I've deliberately scaled that back so that, you know, he's facing asymmetric warfare situations. He goes off on one mission where it's just Dauntless on the mission with no supporting ships. Things like that to try to break it up and give a different feel to it.
Right. Good.
And that's also why
you get a situation in fiction between, you know, there's Batman and he fights guys that are robbing banks. And then there's Superman, and he fights interplanetary invasions, and the fate of the universe hangs in the balance, you know, every issue, right? So you have two completely different scales there, yet both are very interesting because of the hero, not necessarily – you know, you just need something to challenge that person enough, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the fate of everything hangs in the balance at all times.
Right, or, you know, you change the scale of it to make sure it stays human. I created a spin-off series called The Lost Stars that goes with Lost Fleet, and it's actually set in a syndicate, former syndicate star system that's revolted. And it's kind of a fall of empire type thing where they're trying to deal with the collapse of the empire and establish themselves as something better. Mm. But the scale of it, of course, because you're dealing with these remnant forces, is it's much smaller. Mm. You know, you've got engagements with only a few ships on each side. You've got more ground engagements. It mixes things up quite a bit for me and lets me keep things fresh. So when I go back to the Lost Fleet, I've got a different perspective to go into it.
Mm-hmm. So the Syndicate, they struck me as sort of a dystopian fascist corporatocracy, I guess, to mash a bunch of terms together.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you were going for there?
Or a kleptocracy. You know, they're basically the people in charge want all the money and all the power. So they've created a system to justify that.
Hmm. Did you model that after any particular historical situation, or you just said, well,
there's a number of places with aspects of that. It's kind of a mashup of a number of them.
Mm.
Russia's heading in that direction right now, the kleptocracy. So it's kind of a composite, I guess you could say, of a lot of different historical examples.
Okay. And there is on the Alliance side, I don't know religiously what was going on in the Syndicate, but in the Alliance, there was a lot of talk of ancestorism. And, mm-hmm. so it was, I kind of looked at that as sort of a Romanesque sort of thing, whereas a lot of people have, I would consider making the mistake of saying, well, we need a space empire, and the empire that people are familiar with is the Roman Empire. So we're going to name our ships like the Spiculum and the, all these boldly Roman names. And then the government's going to basically be a Roman forum, and we're going to have a guy that's not named Caesar and all that. So, but I sort of see aspects of different human cultures that are in there, but they're subtly in there. So it's like if you know what you're looking for, you see them. But it's not like out and say, oh, yes, it's Emperor Titus of the human fleet.
Yeah, that's. I mean, Rome, you look at the history of Rome, and they went through just about everything that any society could go through, the Republic and the Empire and everything else. So you can certainly get a lot out of that. The ancestor thing, I actually got out of, as I was formulating this, I'd read some things about the oldest known religious site that had found a place in the Middle East, and it was an ancestor worship site.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be interesting to contrast, here's this super high-tech society spanning a big part of the galaxy, and yet their belief system harks back to the oldest form of human belief, honoring their ancestors and thinking about what their ancestors would want. I thought that would be an interesting contrast.
Yeah.
I think it has given me some things to play with.
Well, this war went on for how long? Like 100 years?
It went on for about a century, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at that point, had they not been able to approach each other's worlds and just bomb all the industry off? Or was it just sort of a truce at the border? Or was it a hot war the whole time?
Yeah, it was pretty much a hot war the whole time. It's just you're talking about societies with such immense wealth. So many star systems and easy to access all the wealth in space, the metal in the asteroids, everything else, immensely rich societies by our standards. They could just keep going for a long time. Plus the huge distances involved, the sizes of the populations. Essentially, they were too massive to be easily defeated by either side, kind of like invading Russia. You don't want to do that because it's just too darn big. And that's the situation they were in. The Syndicate, who'd started the war, refused to stop it, and the Alliance refused to surrender, so it just kept going on. Kind of a World War I type situation.
Right, and I was thinking about that. Like, the worlds on the border would almost be kind of trench warfare, right? Because
they would have
gotten
trashed.
Poured out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that doesn't leave a lot of room for ground engagement, though. Right. So it's just fleet things.
There were a lot of ground engagements. Yeah, because the Lost Fleet is focused on the fleet. I don't get into them very much. That's something that's discussed more in the Lost Stars books. But yeah, there were some horrendous big ground actions with tremendous numbers of people lost in the engagements as you tried to literally seize planets.
Hmm. So was it a situation where both sides had their industry like continuously geared for war for a whole century, and they're just constructing ships and shipyards as fast as they can put them out and assembling ships and throwing them at each other?
Yeah, a lot of that. And I mean, a big part of the Beyond the Frontier stuff, the stuff that takes place after the war ends, is the shocks to the Alliance economy when it ends. And all of a sudden, they've got to figure out, oh, peace. How do we handle that? How do we handle jiggering our industry and everything else? Mm. You know, what do we build? How do we do it? Because none of them know that.
Well, that's kind of a parallel to America, World War II, right? Because we had come from a place where we were industrially fairly idle, and then ramped up into this military industrial production machine, right? Where the entire society was building tanks and planes and bombs, and then the war was suddenly over. But for us, that actually became incredible prosperity following that. You know, like the boys came home, they found jobs, but we had to turn the economy. Luckily, we found that Cold War to kind of keep things going. but it was also a thing of all of the industry that had been lacking. There was such an influx of money into that we had, you know, all the latest factory stuff. And then it's like, well, we don't need to make tanks anymore. Hey, we can make consumer goods. And then, you know, capitalism got its great second wind. You know, that I think now, of course, we bombed Japan flat. So they had no legacy factory stuff. So they actually got a jump on us in the reconstruction because we went over and we gave them even newer stuff. You know, and then they were able to apply processes that were more fit to their society. So as far as efficiency and, you know, their whole Kaizen mentality and that. So it's created kind of an interesting economic situation here on Earth. Were you kind of a student of any of that, looking at, well, I'm going to write this book where the war economy now pivots into a civilian state and, you know, what's the aftershock of that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big part of it. Of course, the driving thing wasn't, you know, from the first book of The Lost Fleet, wasn't the economy so much as when I started The Lost Fleet, we had just started the what was once called the Global War on Terrorism type thing. And people were talking about this really long war and, you know, this would be going on for decades type thing. And I wanted to explore the impact on a society if you're in a long war. What does that do to your military? What does that do to your government? What does it do to the way people think?
Mm.
And it has a big effect. You know, Gary comes in there after 100 years of all this, and he's horrified to see some of the things these people do and just accept, because over time they've just gradually changed what they think is an acceptable tactic, an acceptable thing to do.
Mm.
And I saw some aspects of that I wanted to look at. And The Lost Fleet deals with that, and the Beyond the Frontier continues it as the aspects of the Alliance that were grown up as part of the Long War. I mean, there's some parts of that they do not want to let go of the power they gained during the Long War.
So do you have a situation then where, hey, the war is over? Oh yeah, well, we really don't want to get out of the battle cruiser business, so we need to find somewhere else to start sending fleets.
Well, there are some factions with that. There's people who think that internal security, you know, they're going to be looking for different enemies to hunt now that they supposedly don't have to worry about the others. There's some who, frankly, would rather the war continued on so that it would be a predictable thing for them. There's a lot of disruption going on and a lot of, you know, questioning of, okay, so what is it we're supposed to stand for and what is it we should be aiming for? And that's been one of the things bedeviling Gary throughout the series is, you know, why exactly, what role am I supposed to play here aside from just winning victories? I'm from 100 years ago. People think of me as one of the ancestors and they think I'm really wise and something. So what should I be telling them to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, the next book that comes up, Steadfast, he finally figures it out. And so that was a nice moment for me to write the moment when he figures out, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I've factored in the economics and the government stuff and the social stuff because, you know, it's all tied together.
So do you take
all part and parcel?
Because, well, you were saying that as sort of a reflection of the time period of what was going on when you began to write the series, right? And that mm-hmm. colored your telling of the story. So now that you're writing the new works, and the way that things have changed, yet still kind of remain the same, has that further colored what you're doing, or is your fiction separate and it's got its own life and it's not really influenced by current geopolitics?
Well, it still has to grow out of the same thing. You know, I can't do a pivot after, you know, 7 or 8 books in a series. You can't suddenly change direction wildly without making people say, wait a minute, this isn't the same story anymore. So there's that momentum of the storyline. There's the way things are. But that continues to feed into storylines that have resonance today. For example, one of the things that Gary's been dealing with for quite a while has been the issues of secrecy. What is secret and why is it secret? What things are the government keeping from the people of the alliance? What things should they be keeping from them? And what things should they actually be talking about? So that's been an important issue in the last few books, but it's been one that's been there all along. It's probably getting a little more emphasis now, and that's probably a reflection of some of the things we're discussing in real life right now.
Okay. So have you had any fans of the series submit their own short fiction that is perhaps in the same universe that you've created, but not necessarily anywhere in view of the characters that you've created?
No, not that I have found.
Okay. Because I see that, you know, as a source book for, hey, here's this universe and here's how it works, and we're all familiar with that. So then, you know, I could write a story about some James Bond kind of guy that, you know, mm-hmm. is like doing something else, right? An espionage thing that's going on in a syndicate world or whatever. Has the temptation ever hit you to maybe divert over to a couple of short stories about characters that are away from this, you know, I don't know. Do you ever get tired of writing about the same people and bringing that? And it's just like, hey, I want to talk about somebody's second cousin that you never heard of before and just do something.
Like I said, something different. Yeah. That's why I created the Lost Stars. They're very different people. You know, they were raised to believe in totally different things. Some very unusual characters. For example, Colonel Morgan. She's a bit psychotic, and she's very much a secret agent type. So it's fun to write about her. It's fun to write about all those people in that environment who have this very different approach to the way they think. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that gives me the different perspectives because as you say, after a while, it does get tired. It does get hard to keep coming up with new things, new situations. And so far I've done it. Got one more book contract after Steadfast. I don't know. I might have to take a break after that because I want to make sure I keep it good. And it's been a challenge. But the Lost Stars has played a big role in keeping it fresh because they're such totally different people and different situations I can get them involved in. The short answer is yes. I have to do that kind of thing. So, and there may be some short stories coming up too that will be canon. Actually, I have written a couple short stories, come to think of it. One was called Grendel, which was about Geary's first battle, the one where he got put into suspended animation. And the other was called Flesh, which was about the battle where Tanya Dejani earned her Alliance Fleet Cross, the one she never wants to talk about. So I did write those two.
Okay. So if you had to step away from science fiction, or at least this particular type of science fiction, for one effort, you know, not like a series or whatever. But if we said, hey, we're going to hire you and we want you to write some sort of fiction that is just not spaceships, like where do you go? What would be your first pick?
A What a coincidence you should ask me that. First, I've been working on a series I call Steampunk with Dragons. It's science fiction primarily. It's real steam, boilers and steam locomotives and stuff, and horse cavalry and dragons. I finally have this series has been picked up by Audible. They're going to be bringing out the audiobooks this fall. The first one's called The Dragons of Dorecastle. And it's been a fun series to write. It's very different. One of the main characters is what's called a mechanic on her world, and she is a basically she's somebody who knows technology and knows how to fix things. And to her guild, the mechanics control all the technology, which is mostly steam level. And then the other character is a mage who believes that nothing is real and is able to do things the mechanics can't explain. And they drive each other crazy because they're both doing things the other think is impossible. But they're a lot of fun together. And it's, well, it's an epic series, of course, because it's she ends up having to step into a role she's not at all enthusiastic about, sort of saving the day for everyone.
That seems a theme in your work. Yeah, is the reluctant hero.
The reluctant hero, yeah.
Right.
I don't like people who want to be heroes. They're dangerous for everyone around them.
Well, you had that guy, and he was stone cold crazy. I forget his name, but you know, he was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that guy. Sorry.
I do like to explore the different aspects of the reluctant hero. Hopefully I don't always make them out the same way. In my Jagged Space series, the reluctant hero was basically just a junior officer who's confronted with ethical dilemmas at different points. You know, he leads a firefighting team on a ship and somebody gets killed, and then there's a question of, you know, do you ask the questions about how the fire started? And do you bring the golden boy, Admiral's son, to court-martial on this kind of thing? So, you know, there's different levels of reluctant heroes, from the ones who are going to save dozens of planets to the ones who's going to try to free our world from a dominating system to somebody who's just trying to do the right thing within their own little section of their fleet.
Yeah. So since you've consumed a lot of science fiction and produced some science fiction, I wanted to ask you about this. So there's science fiction for the sake of spaceships and lasers are cool. And then there's science fiction for saying, okay, we're going to take a very human situation, like what you're talking about there, you know, the reluctant hero and just the aspects of the characters, right? So people are people. And they may be in space. They may be, you know, in like a Viking longboat and not a spaceship, right? But it's a human situation, right? So you write books that are more about the character, not so much, look how cool these spaceships are. You know, they're a backdrop to that.
Yeah. I do try to make it about the people no matter what the situation is, because I think the people – no matter how cool you make the background, if the people aren't real, if the people aren't memorable, then, well, it's not my kind of story. For example, I wrote one story. It was a novella-length story called Swords and Saddles, where I had realized there are not many science fiction stories featuring the U.S. Mounted Cavalry. And there are also not many science fiction stories set in Kansas. So I wrote one. It was kind of a tribute to H. Bean Piper's story, where a company of U.S. cavalry gets tossed into an alternate universe that's pre-gunpowder, and they've got carbines. But that was still, despite all the stuff about the cavalry and everything else, it was still mainly about the captain who's in charge of that force, trying to look after his soldiers and figure out the situation they're in, and the woman who's leading the forces there in that alternate universe that he allies with. The story hinges on them and what they do. And that's the way I do things. And I think it makes better stories when it's about the people.
Okay. So if you were going to a desert island and you're going to be there for a year, and I say, okay, you can take one book, one movie, and one video game. Which?
Okay, let's see. Book. I'd probably bring the collected Shakespeare because it would take forever to get through it. And it's one of those things I've always said, you ought to read all these someday. And I finally would. Let's see, one movie. So it'd have to be a movie I could watch over and over again. Maybe Galaxy Quest, because there's so many little things in there that you spot. Oh, yeah, they made fun of that, too.
Yeah.
Let's see, video game. Maybe Civilization. You can play that forever.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, probably Civilization, just because you can just keep going with it. You could play that for a year.
Yeah. Did you play Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri?
Yeah, I did a couple times.
Okay. Because that was essentially a Civilization, but you removed that to space.
Yeah, science fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of illustrative of what I was saying about, science fiction is about situations, but it might be a science fiction situation. It constructs the metaphor a little bit better or in a more attention-grabbing way than that, but it's still the same situation. You're still playing Civilization. It's just a few of the things are different. But yeah, I think I look at some things like, well, what Lucas did with Star Wars, which is kind of actually a retelling of, I forget what the Japanese movie was. It was, darn. I knew it until I wanted to say it. But anyway, it was, everything's kind of iterative. In that aspect. Mm-hmm. So is that kind of what drove the science fiction thing with you? Why did you decide, okay, I'm going to write science fiction instead of cowboys?
I think it's because I like exploring how people interact with technology, but also how no matter how the technology changes, the people stay the same.
Mm.
The different settings, I like being able to – I've always liked history. And mythology and the idea of being able to create your own history and mythology and a present day based on that is just a lot of fun for me.
Yeah. By the way, Nack in the chat just corrected me. It's it was Hidden Fortress was the Japanese movie that I was talking about.
Oh, Hidden Fortress.
So, yeah. Yeah. So I find that there's a lot of things, like the old Kurosawa movies and these themes. Yeah. That had come up, and that's what I find fascinating about. I go back to really old movies sometimes, and even stuff from the 70s and 80s. And the 80s was a crazy magical time, and I think it's partially due because of videotape, because there was the movie industry, and then they were really reluctant to embrace VHS because they said, oh well, the VHS is going to impact the movie industry. But what they found out was the movie industry kept its money and VHS was a brand new pile of money. And suddenly Hollywood was like, money, money for everybody. Come make a movie, stick it on VHS, right? So anything made. And there's this other podcast that I do where we do that. We sit and watch kind of like the worst of the 80s that we can find and just to prove like anything could get made back then. It was actually a 90s movie. We watched Leprechaun. The last time around,
Jeff's
debut, another movie that proves anything could get made back then. But it's, I look at the old influences of stories and that, and you see the same themes kind of come up again and again, whether it was, a high quality science fiction movie or, it's when you had a budget that was very low and you had a supply of money and, you're a guy like Roger Corman and you can make five movies a week and you just throw them against the wall and see what ideas stick. And and I think that was actually a really good phase for creativity because we got to see, other than what happened with Star Wars, which was a crazy aberration and I think has warped our society terribly. If we never had Star Wars and all we had was Star Trek, what's the world like today? Because Star Wars, the commercial success of that, bent everybody to say, I got to make Star Wars also.
Well, yeah, and unfortunately, a lot of them thought that it meant if I put a big spaceship on here, I don't have to worry about writing a good story.
That's true.
And there's so many of those.
It's called Star Crash. It was made in Italy. It's got David Hasselhoff with a lightsaber fighting stop motion robots. I urge you to seek that out.
You're going to mention that every week now.
I do. My goal in life is that everyone will have an opportunity to see Star Crash.
Everyone needs to see Star Crash. Damn it.
Yeah, there's some god awful movies out there. One of the things, you know, back in the 70s, early 80s in the fleet, we would get reel to reel movies sent out to the ships. That's how we would watch movies back then, reel to reel. Wow. And when we get a really bad one, we just mix up the reels to try to make it a little more interesting. Okay, let's put in reel 3 now instead of reel 2. Maybe this will be more interesting then. We got some really bad films.
Yeah. So where do you hang out as far as other science fiction writers? Do you guys all have like a secret clubhouse? And you hang out there.
Well, there's a website, sff.net, and a lot of us hang out there. There's a pro group in there where we can talk about stuff, but also a lot of us have individual pages and communities. I don't know why I can't remember the word. And then I also, there's some time on Facebook, you know, there's a Lost Fans of Lost Fleet page there, and we, people, talk about things, exchange things, and real world, I like to go to conventions and sit down with people and just talk, fans and writers. It's tremendously recharging in terms of getting ideas and thinking about things.
Hmm. Do they have sci-fi conventions that are just pure sci-fi convention, or is it always themed like, oh, it's a Star Trek or Star Wars or you know, one of the big hitters? Or is it just like, here's a bunch of random science fiction convention thing, anything goes?
I don't think there's any pure SF conventions anymore. Nowadays, I think, you know, there's the huge media ones, the things like Dragon Con and Comic Con. And then there's the ones that are more about written stuff, Balticon here or Bubonicon in New Mexico. And those tend to be a mix of science fiction and fantasy. They have movie sections. They've all got anime because, you know, anime drives so much. Mm. As it should, because it's a tremendously inventive field. I just love the way they just throw things together and see what works, like you were saying about VHS.
Yeah, and that was the thing when in the 80s, is it's very cheap to test an idea in anime. You know, it's like – and well, it's man hours. They have to draw that stuff. But still, as opposed to spinning up a movie production company, especially in this day – when you're expected that if you're going to get a movie brought to the theater, that means that it has to be a prepackaged 3-movie deal. You know, it's guaranteed success, and you're going to clear $400 million on opening weekend. And I think that just makes it impossible for anybody to get any fresh air in the room.
Well, you're right. It is very hard. And the Japanese certainly, they do things that we don't. The Miyazaki film last year, the one from Studio Ghibli, from Up on Poppy Hill.
Mm.
I mean, it wasn't science fiction. It wasn't fantasy. It was just set in Yokohama in 1964, dealing with issues of the past and the future and the fallout from World War II in Korea. And just a beautiful film. Wonderful to watch. And would it have been made in the U.S.? Probably not.
Mm.
Well,
the Japanese have sort of a different perspective in the aftermath of World War II than what we do, and I think there's a lot to be learned from that, because we were the victorious, yay, our boys came home and we won and we had a booming economy, and you know what was bad about it, you know, of course it was terrible when it went on, but hey, we won and everything's great. Versus with Japan, you know, it's like, well, you're sitting in a destroyed country and you have to think about the wisdom of like, how did we get into that situation and who thought that was a good idea and how do we pick the pieces up and go on? kind of thing.
Mm.
And that's a thing I don't see addressed. I would like to see that in a work of science fiction where, you know, maybe you're the empire that lost. The good guys mm-hmm. don't always have to win. Unfortunately, that seems to be the unwritten rule, is the good guys win, and then there's no hard decisions in the aftermath. Mm-hmm.
Except for Firefly.
Yeah, Firefly.
If Fox ever does a mini series of the Lost Fleet, they'll probably do the books out of order. You know.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's the risk you always take. Yeah. One of the things that with the Japanese with anime, I mentioned earlier that new series which is available in the U.S. now, Girls und Panzer, and it's insane by Western standards because the basic storyline is what we would consider a girl's story. You know, it's about making friends and cooperating and doing things together. But they do it with tanks. Girls' schools compete with each other by crewing actual World War II vintage tanks with teams of girls, and high school girls.
Traditionally, we have not really strengthened our friendship through tank warfare.
No,
so that's an interesting take.
They do in this. So you got the tanks, which is a pure, you know, it's actual realistic tactics and everything. It is purely what you would consider a boys' show. And then you've got the actual storyline, which is the girls' underdog team that has to win by working together and making friends story. You would never see that in the West. You would never see those two elements combined because somebody would say, well, is this aimed at boys or at girls? And the answer would be yes.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it works.
I was just reading an article about that's the reason why Young Justice was killed, because more girls are watching it than boys.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's absolutely insane. Sorry.
Because they spend a lot of money. They spend just as much money as the guys do. It's purely a matter of, you know, self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah.
But the imagination, the ability to look beyond the box is just a very important thing.
Yeah.
And I certainly salute anime in terms of being able to do that.
Right. Well, Knack brings up another thing in chat where he's like, you know, about watching Superdimensional Fortress Macross, however you pronounce it, mm-hmm. Robotech to us here in America. But it's the whole notion that you can defeat the entire alien empire with a song. And a pretty girl. That's so uniquely. Have you not seen Macross?
No.
Oh my God! Show's over. All right. Yeah. So
I'm not that big into.
Well, Min Mei is this girl, and she sings a song, right? And it's like a Star Search kind of thing, you know. And she's on, and they play this for the morale of all the fighter pilots that are out there doing the valiant last stand against the enemy, and they take this girl who's essentially like Lady Gaga, right, but a lot more innocent and whatever, and she sings this song about love and that, and the aliens that they're fighting can understand it. They don't really relate to the concept because they're all genetically engineered, test tube born, 50-foot tall giant men. You know, and the you find out later there are women of the species, but they're continuously in conflict with each other, right? But imagine a bunch of 50-foot tall Spartans that drive giant robots and have big spaceships, and then they get hit with a love song, and it just melts their brains, and they're paralyzed with it, and they just don't know, you know, their entire system is destroyed because this love song just, you know, puts a tear in their eye, and they can't process it. And that's how we win. So, spoilers, but that's a thing, that anime will try, and they succeeded amazingly with it. But it's just so much experimental stuff that comes out, and I guess that's the deal, is when Hollywood demands, you know, that you're gonna break records with everything that comes out the gate, and they're not willing to take risks on throwaway projects for the fun of the game, right? Then I think we get so stifled in creativity that a lot of things just can't get out into the light.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you there. I mean, it is a real problem. I mean, you can see it with Pixar, who came out with some really brilliant, innovative products, but now they're at the point where, you know, they come out with a new film and everybody immediately says, oh, it's not as good as Up.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what is?
Well, what's the solution for that? Do you just tear it down and start up a new name somewhere where people don't have the expectations and you start over again and that's how you have your creativity?
Yeah, I think so. Where people, you know, they will go off and do side projects where they can indulge that sort of thing and just try something new.
Right. So, like, if you decide, okay, I'm going to write Westerns from now on and I'm done with sci-fi, do you have to change your name again? Because people pick up a Jack Campbell book and they're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, what's this Western thing? And, you know, so.
You know, that's a good question. I mean, traditionally people have done that, but there have been other people who have written a wide variety of things and use the same name. So I don't know what the answer would be on that. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this Steampunk with Dragons things goes, because it's obviously not the same as the other Jack Campbell stuff.
Right.
I think it's pretty good, but I'll see if the Jack Campbell people who like my stuff give it a chance or not.
Yeah.
Or will they say it's something different?
I just want to say I love dragons, like, a lot. So I will – the Temeraire –
I can tell.
Have you read the Temeraire series of books?
Yeah, part of it.
I do love those, and yes, How to Train Your Dragon, my favorite movie ever. So I'm excited that – I like steampunk too, so I will definitely read it. And while I've been sitting here trying not to cough, I purchased the first book in the new series, the Beyond the – oh, God. You know what I'm talking about.
Beyond the Frontier?
Yeah.
Dreadnought.
Yeah, so I'm gonna start reading that tonight. Very excited.
So, John, have you ever read any of Larry Correia's stuff? He did the Monster Hunter International series.
Yeah, I read one or two of those.
Yeah, I
don't get to read nearly as much as I want to.
Yeah, it's. I thought that was kind of interesting though, because he sort of had a different take on the thing. And Brian, since you're such a fan of the TV show Supernatural. I think you're the target audience for this. So,
really? What's it called?
Yeah,
what's
Monster Hunter again? International. It's a it's sort of a secret group of monster hunters that are there because of a loophole in some treaty that was made back in the, like, Revolutionary War days to farm out ghost busting to mercenaries, pretty much, because the government didn't want to own that. It's kind of interesting, and the guy that wrote the thing, he's a gun store owner, and he's very, very into his firearms. Right, the books actually kind of they border on gun porn at some points, but it's kind of like, well, I dreamed up this really cool gun, now I got to put my hero in a situation where he gets to kill stuff with it, you know. But it's also he does things like where a team of Navy SEALs takes down a oil tanker that's infested with vampires, right? So you have, like, your tactical room sweeping thing, you know, that a SEAL team would do, and then it also happens to be, like, steak and vampires. So it's very interesting, but it's just a thing of, you know, talking about, like, branching out into other things. It just reminded me of his books, especially with, like, the steampunk thing and that. But there was one scene I have to kind of spoil, where they talk about they're going to go to the enchanted garden or the enchanted forest. I think it was enchanted forest, to meet the queen of the elves, right? So they all get in the Winnebago. And they drive out into the heart of like Mississippi swamp area, and there is a mobile home park called the Enchanted Forest, and there are a bunch of, like, redneck elves that live out there, and yeah, it's great. The book takes like traditional tropes about fantasy writing and kind of stands them on their head every now and then. It's pretty hilarious, but anyway, that's. That's my plug for his book. He'll never listen to the show. So,
well, it's kind of getting late. We should wrap this up. I'm not doing so well. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah, you sound like you're going to die over there. You're coughing. And
I'm coming down with something. This is what happens when you date a teacher who deals with petri dishes all day.
Yeah.
Or children, as most people call them.
Yes, yes. Schools are plague zones. Yeah.
the Black Death.
Yeah. Hey, did you hear the news about the Black Death, by the way? They uncovered some graves in London, and they found out that the Black Death – we've always thought that it was because of fleas that were on the rats. But then they said, oh, no, that now we've got evidence that it was actually an airborne plague because it couldn't have done the things that it did given a rat infection vector.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. So it's kind of interesting. I'm kind of hopeful that when they dig all these plague bodies up that they don't, like, stir that back up into the air. That would be a little unfortunate. But, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's still out there. I mean, it's there's a lot of it down in the American Southwest. The underground rodent colonies, bubonic plague. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I wasn't aware that we still had it creeping around. Hey, that's another reason to stay out of Texas.
Between that and that super virus they uncovered in Antarctica, whatever that was. Yeah, we're in for some fun times.
Yeah. Oh, there was talk about like the speaking of history and that. So the Spanish flu, which killed basically everybody in Europe. So there was some speculation about, well, what if we found somebody that was a Spanish flu victim that was frozen, right? Now that all the permafrost is melting and that, you know, what if we found somebody from that time that got frozen because of exposure and has remained frozen all this time and they thaw out and somebody finds him? Now we have that virus live again because, like, nobody knows what it was.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I actually did a time travel story on it because it was so unusual. Like a typical flu, it killed mostly healthy young adults because it attacked caused the immune system to overreact. So the healthier you were, the more likely you were to die. And once it had gone swath through and killed so many millions of people, it disappeared. So yeah, very weird.
Yeah, pretty strange stuff. But that's what makes me nervous about. You know, when they're down in like the forests in Brazil, right, and they're plowing like untouched virgin territory to harvest all these trees and stuff, and people talk about like they had that one movie where they were talking about, well, maybe the cure for cancer was down there, you know, and we just like killed whatever had it, you know, but it's so many of our medicines come from these discoveries and that. So, but I was thinking about, well, what about like all the new viruses that you're turning over, you know, like things that humans have not been exposed to before ever. And then we're going into these new places and yeah. So
it was like that Sean Connery movie where he found the cure for cancer in the rainforest.
That's the one I'm talking about. Yeah. I can't
Medicine
remember the
Man.
Name of it.
Medicine Man.
All right. But once again, Sean Connery can always be counted on to save the day.
Crazy ass ponytail. I remember that movie.
have you ever seen Zardoz?
Oh, I love that.
Oh, God.
I love that movie. They had a nice little homage to that in Community recently.
Oh, really?
It was great.
I'll have to look that up.
You will. It's the Meow Meow Beans episode, if that helps.
Oh, gosh. All right.
Anyway.
I'll let you guys get.
John, thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your evening.
Thanks for listening to me, letting me ramble on.
And I'm sorry, like I said, I didn't talk much. I would have if I was healthy, but
yeah. And if you could send us, is there any sort of a press kit or whatever for the new book that's coming out that'll give us some idea of like when it's going to hit the street and that, and then we'll pass that info along in the post.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have the publisher send you something. It's coming out on the 4th of May, Steadfast.
So. Okay. That's coming up pretty quick then.
We could still put it in the show notes. Yeah. Yeah. Have them send me whatever they have.
Okay. Sure. Well, thanks.
Awesome. Of course. That's kind of what we do. That's one of the reasons we do this is to promote people. But yeah, we love your books, folks. If you haven't read them and you like space combat, and I have a feeling you do, because you're listening to us. The Lost Fleet series. What was the first one again? Oh, God.
Dauntless.
Yeah. Dauntless is the first one. Check it out. It's excellent. And the space combat is just really, like, I've read a lot of sci-fi, and yeah, it's nothing really else like it.
Yeah, was there any confusion with the readers about the order to read the books in? Because, you know, like, if you come to it late, it's like, well, here's six books, and they're all named after ships, but it's not like Lost Fleet 1, 2, 3. You know, so.
Yeah, there is occasionally people asking me, you know, what order should it be read in. For some reason, only the French and the Japanese actually number them.
Wow.
Nobody else does. So I don't know why that is.
All they have to do is look up your Wikipedia page. It's all right there.
But I deliberately try to write them so if somebody picks up, you know, the third book in the series or something instead of the first, they can catch up and figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
So.
Totally. Totally, which is common in a lot of series. A lot of like one of my favorite series is the Dresden Files.
Mm-hmm.
Every book has a bit of that. So yeah, that seems common. But you got to, because someone might jump in book 4 or book 12 or whatever.
Yes. Yeah, with the Dresden Files. Yeah.
Exactly. All right, man. Well, folks, thanks for listening. And if you have any questions or comments about this podcast, feel free to leave them below or contact us at, hail@spacegamejunkie.com. Jim, thanks as always remember when we first started this podcast and I was sick and we had Chris Roberts on and you like asked everything because I couldn't talk?
Yeah.
Kind of like that. So I appreciate you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Damn shame.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, again, thanks, folks. We'll end on that. Have a good night.
All right.
Oh, my God.
And thanks for stopping by, John.
Let's have some music in here, Boiler. Sure thing.
I see sunshine down, but I see only one. I'm trying to think I'm over you. I find I'm just begun. Faster than the days, there's no warmth in the light. And how I miss those desert skies, you're